Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Dan Levesey, and today I'm speaking with Jack Green, Andrew W. Mellon Professor Emeritus at Johns Hopkins and Fellow in Residence at the John Carter Brown Library. And today we'll be discussing his recent book, Settler Jamaica in the 1750s, A Social Portrait. Jack, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for asking me.
So your book looks at Jamaica in the middle of the 18th century, and I was wondering why this particular time was of such interest to you and how you got into this project in particular?
Well, my research interests in the era from the late 1740s through the very early 1760s dates back a really long way to the early 1950s. But in 1963 or so, I decided that I was going to write a book, which I never have done, on the efforts of the metropolis of the Metropolitan Colonial Administration to alter many of the de facto or customary constitutions of so many of the American colonies. I noticed this phenomenon in my first book, which was about legislative government in Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia during the from the Glorious Revolution to the American Revolution. In 1963, I spent the entire summer in London reading through all the documents for all the British American colonies, all the islands as well as those on the continent, from about 1745 to 1763. And of course, Jamaica was one of those colonies, and I investigated it in particular detail because the volumes of manuscripts were so large on it. I concluded that it was at the forefront of colonial resistance during those years, and because it was the scene of two major constitutional struggles between 1762 and 1766, both of which were successful struggles, as well as a fair number of lesser things going on in Jamaica at the time. And indeed, Jamaica became the only colony before the Stamp Act to be subjected to parliamentary censures on relating to its domestic governance. I was already deeply involved in looking at the middle of the 18th century before I discovered these documents in the I can't remember if the West or the East Sussex Record Office in Britain. And I was directed there by this magnificent bibliography that Kenneth Ingram, who was a librarian at the University of West Indies in Mona, reading through, looking for political things relating to my political and constitutional study, I I happened to notice that there were these two documents that he mentions, doesn't describe them very fully. And so when I actually went there to get copies of these documents that I wanted to use in this political project, I saw those two documents, one of which was a census, a complete census of the free population in Spanish Town, the capital of Jamaica, in 1754, and the other of which was a detailed list of the properties in the five surrounding parishes that depended upon Spanish Town, and it listed a whole, gave quite a bit of data on what crops each one of them produced. So I made copies of these, and I thought, this is, you may, well, you wouldn't probably remember this, because you're not old enough, but in the early 70s, social history was becoming the rage. And I thought, gee, that will make a really nice article for past and present. But when I actually started to do a little work on them, I discovered that an article wouldn't do. And so I thought, I knew about some other comparable documents that could flesh this out. And over the next, 15 years or so, I managed to find a number of other documents. And it's the document, this is very much a document-driven book. Every chapter is driven by a particular document. In some cases, it required two chapters for each of these documents. But this is that's the way I got interested initially in Jamaica, and its political, through its political history.
Yeah, and those documents really are so central. You sort of mentioned a couple of them already, but I wonder, because they're such an elemental part of how you're constructing this book, if you can talk about the records themselves. And you mentioned in the book how hard it is to do research on this period of Jamaican history, that there's a lot kind of at the end of the 18th century when abolitionism is driving a lot of political interest to Jamaica and the West Indies. But for 1750, it's hard to find sources on the island. So could you say a little bit more about the types of records that you look at in order to sketch out the island at mid-century?
Well, actually, yeah, I can certainly do that. But I think it's not true that it's difficult to do research. I mean, it's difficult because you have to go to Spanish Town and Kingston. And Spanish Town is not the most friendly environment. There's nowhere to eat there, and there's no hotel, and it's 17 miles away from the university. And so you more or less either have to rent a car, or if you're really brave and want to take a lot of time, you can take a bus over there. And Phil Morgan actually did that for an entire summer. When he was in his early 30s or so, but there, that the archive in Jamaica is really quite magnificent, and it's very well run, very well organized, and not much has been stolen from it, and practically nothing has decayed from in the way that it has in many of the smaller islands. Barbados also has a very good archive. But in addition to that, they have the National Library of Jamaica, which when I first encountered it was called the Institute of Jamaica, and they have a lot of manuscripts there, as well as printed materials, which were collected in an earlier by an early director, Frank Condell, and then there's the Island Record Office, which has all the wills going back. So you can really find an enormous amount. I mean, the testimony to this is the incredible output by Trevor Bernard of articles. I mean, he must have 40 articles, well, at least 30 articles. that pertain to just about every aspect of life, all of which is dug out of those archives. That was his first job, as was at the University of the West Indies. He was there not for very long, but two or three years. And he spent a lot of time, he's very energetic, and he spent a lot of time in the archives in Spanish Town. Had a car, he could drive over there, I think. That's the best way to do research there, is to rent a car, I think, and drive back and forth over there. And then the volume of materials in the public record, in the National Archives now in London, is incredible. I mean, it's really a large, because they were, the imperial government was so interested in Jamaica. And there's a lot of stuff in the British Museum. There's a lot of stuff brought over by absentees, scattered in places like the West Sussex record office. So there really is just an enormous volume of material. The problem is that for a young scholar who doesn't have independent means, it's hard to work on these subjects because the stuff is widely scattered. But it's possible to do an enormous amount of good work on that, and a lot of work has been done on it. The archives in Jamaica get particularly good when they start keeping plantation account records, and that's what much of Barry Higman's extraordinary output has rested upon, as well as those of several other scholars who haven't been quite as productive as he has. So it's just a matter of neglect, and I think this is rooted probably not in the absence of sources, but in the fact that the people, many of the people who work on Jamaica, do so from the University of the West Indies in Mona, and much of the best work has been done, and they are more interested in focusing on the history of the population that I don't talk about in this book very much, but is there in the background and essential to Jamaican society, which is the black population, and they focus on things about abolition and so forth. So, just not many people have worked on that on this early period. I mean, these documents, some of the documents I've used have been worked on. The one on St. Andrew's Parish was written about by Frank Pittman in the Fest Shrift for Charles McLean Andrews. And then David Ryden, who wrote an excellent article on it sometime after I had finished those chapters. But it has a more economic focus than mine does. So there has been some attention, but much less on the 18th century.
Well, let's get into some of the...
I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, no, it does. I think you're right. Part of the issue is that it is hard to get out to places like Spanish Town and Central Village and Kingston. And I think that there's also, as you mentioned, kind of... a lot on enslaved populations, and it's sometimes harder to get a sense of some of the free populations. And so maybe we should get into the actual findings that you have in the book itself. One of the things that I liked was you really portray Jamaica as a very diverse island. It's not just this kind of singular place. And you have a great map early in the book that categorizes the different parishes in Jamaica into a core, a periphery, and a near periphery area. And that's a pretty crucial part of the way that you're outlining what's happening in Jamaica in the 18th century. So can you just talk a little bit about some of the key differences between those different regions?
It's somewhat complicated because my point in using those was not to make the point that they're economically or socially entirely different, but to emphasize their relationship to where the main center of life was, which was in an axis around Kingston and Spanish Town. That was the most heavily settled area, not just because Kingston was such a large town, and Spanish Town was not an insignificant sized town, but also because that was a fully settled area with lots of people doing lots of things. That's where the legislature and the courts met, and where most of the merchants resided. These outports, Port Antonio, was scarcely anything in 1750, and the same is true with Ocho Rios and Montego Bay and those places along the north coast. Contrary to one review of this book, my use of core periphery doesn't have anything to do with world systems theory. It's rather an extension of the center periphery model that I developed in the 1980s in my book, Peripheries and Center, to explain relations between the metropolitan state and the colonial polities in the structure and governance of the empire. D.W. Meinig, I don't know if anybody reads him still, but he's a historical geographer who used a similar construct to depict social and economic and spatial change in the colonies and diversity among those based upon where they were in relationship to whatever kind of center a colony, almost every colony had one. And ultimately, my thinking on this subject derived from an essay by the sociologist Edward Schill, simply called Peripheries and Center. He called it center and peripheries. I wanted to emphasize the power of the periphery, so I reversed that term. He wrote this really penetrating essay in the 1960s. It used the concept to match out cultural diversity within societies. Settler Jamaica, I employ this concept mostly just to define Jamaica's political core and the relationship between it and the rest of the island, the core's influence weakening as parishes became more distant from it. And the core parishes, however, differed profoundly from one another. And the same can be said for all those parishes in the other two categories, the near periphery and the periphery. That said, however, I think the core parishes tended to depend on more heavily on livestock and provision raising, though some of that was going on everywhere. And all the heaviest producers of sugar were in or immediately adjacent to the peripheries. So there is a kind of, and the peripheries are strange because, you know, it's not like in Virginia or Pennsylvania where the East is settled first and then people move west. I mean, in Jamaica, the South Coast was settled first and then people spread out from there as they could. There are peripheral areas on the East and on the West, and the West is the heavy sugar producing, but there's one parish in the East, St. Thomas in the East, which is also a very heavy sugar producer, whereas none of those parishes in the center produce an extraordinary amount of sugar. They produce a bit, and more in some than in others. And then in the near periphery, those parishes closest to the peripheral ones are the parishes where there's a large amount of sugar production. But if you take Clarendon, which is the main, one of the largest, and which is just about 10, 15 miles west of Spanish Town. If you look at Clarendon, that's the most heavily settled and very prosperous and has a very vigorous and quite diverse economy with a lot of sugar plantations, but also a whole lot of pens or ranches. Jamaicans call ranches pens, and also provision grounds, as well as a lot of miners production, a lot of miner staples in that area. So my use of this term is more political than it is to be descriptive, because within each of these categories, there are places that don't fit the stereotype I just laid out. So.
Yeah, and one of the things that kind of comes out is that you're pushing out against maybe a misperception that a general audience might have of Jamaica, which is that it's an island just completely dominated by sugar and it just has a kind of uniform distribution of enslaved people. And you sort of touched on this a little bit, talking about Clarendon and some of the core peripheries. But I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about the degree to which we have other economies in Jamaica in the middle of the 18th century and the ways that enslaved people are perhaps distributed across the island.
Well, there are some really quite stunning, I think, findings in this book. And one is the numerical predominance of the small proprietors. They were, you know, they constituted at least 80% of the free population. They, together with people who are tradesmen and doing other things, not owning big plantations. And the diversity of land use is extraordinary too. I mean, there are just all kinds of uses of land. And then finally, the other thing that I think is really unusual is the, or that is striking, is the ubiquity of enslavement and its wide use for any kind of thing you could talk about. Slaves were asked to do those things and trained to do trades, for instance. You can see this in the Spanish town list that I have with regard to the free blacks in that town. And they are not slaves or former slaves, but they have been trained. Many of the men have been trained as artisans of one kind or another, somehow bought or won their freedom in some way, and they're continuing to pursue those trades as much as possible. This was a society that, though it had an infrastructure of free people, depended really heavily in every aspect of its being on its enslaved population. I think the great range of places. Now, it's also true that a truism, for instance, is that Jamaica, that sugar supplied most of the sugar accounted for most of the sugar plantations accounted for most of the slaves, and that sugar products dominated the export trade in Jamaican products. And those things are, you know, are certainly true. I wouldn't dispute either of those for a moment. But it was a much more diverse place. I think the problem comes from the fact that people treat the West Indies as a category, which in some ways it can be done. But Jamaica is just very different from any of the other islands. It's many times larger than Jamaica, than the Barbados, which was the largest of the smaller islands. It's almost as large as Connecticut. It's a great deal larger than Rhode Island or Delaware. And it's not that much smaller than New Hampshire, New Jersey, or even Massachusetts. So, without Maine. It's a place that is bound to be more diverse. So, I think if there were similar kinds of documents about Barbados, it would be found. We already know that Barbados had a much higher percentage of white people in relation to the enslaved than did the Leeward Islands, much less the new slave colonies created after the Treaty of Paris in 1763. But I think you'd find a kind of similar white population floating around underneath in Barbados. It wouldn't be as extensive and varied in terms of the economic activities, but it would be there probably nonetheless.
Well, I don't know if this is helpful in terms of thinking about these ideas, but would you call Jamaica a frontier society in this period of time? Again, you chart the ways in which sugar was certainly dominant, but it wasn't the only thing that was being pulled out of the ground. And, in this mid-18th century period, one could look at it and say, well, sugar was pretty dominant in the Caribbean at this time. Generally, big slave owners were kind of monopolizing a lot of land. But do you see it actually as a little bit more of a kind of variable frontier-like experience? Or are you starting to see economic monopolization going on in Jamaica at this time?
Well, I think there's another point we should talk about a bit, which is Jamaica's proximity to the Spanish Main. But let's not forget to talk about that. But to answer this question you raised more directly, just before the 1750s, in the 15 year before, Jamaica was very much like South Carolina at the same time. And what Georgia would become in the 1760s and 1770s, in that there was a lot of land that before had been unsafe to try to establish any kind of establishment on, that after the peace with the Maroons in 1739 suddenly was opened up. A lot of that expansion of sugar culture came during that time, but so also did a lot of the expansion with smaller staples and provisions and cattle raising. So it's very much and Jamaica is attracting a fair number of immigrants who are succeeding in these places. You can't go to Jamaica and build a sugar estate unless you find a rich widow, or you have an extraordinary, at least a couple thousand pounds that you can invest in buying the plant and the labor that's necessary to produce. But you can produce ginger and cotton with a handful of laborers and without any special plant expenses. And a lot of that was obviously going on. In these counties that were – in these parishes that were settled principally after the peace with the Maroons. That Maroon War went on from the late 1720s to 1739, and it really did arrest settlement, much in the way that that King Philip's War arrested in New England and Bacon's Rebellion and the Indian War surrounding Bacon Rebellion. It really did slow down settlement and expansion. And that same thing happened in Jamaica. And it does take a lot of money to build up a major sugar plantation.
And did you want to talk a little more about the role of the Spanish and the Spanish Main in this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, well, you know, one of the things is that I think we haven't talked very much about is Jamaica's role in the empire. And since its conquest, the metropolitan government, I think, regarded Jamaica as a potentially most valuable colony, like the potential most valuable player on a baseball team or something. Primarily, I think, because it was so big in relative to their other island possessions, and it's had a you could tell, I mean, the Spaniards had already had some plantations there, some cocoa plantations, and they could tell very quickly that this was, the soil was rich and that they could produce a lot of things there. But the thing that was unique about Jamaica, other than its size, was the fact that it was so close to the Spanish Main. And this was regarded by Cromwell, and who backed this expedition that took Jamaica, opening up vast possibilities for trade with the Spanish. Trade which the Spanish regard, of course, as illegal, but which that didn't apply to Englishmen. It wasn't illegal unless these English people were caught. And so Jamaica became a big center for, and I think nobody has really done a study about how much of its of the returns they were bringing to England came from the trade they were carrying on in English goods. Jamaica serving as a kind of transshipment point with areas in Venezuela and what's now Venezuela and Colombia and Panama and other places on the coast. Jamaica was very close, and a lot of people made a lot of money doing that. They also made money privateering, and some people made money as pirates in the 17th century, but the Jamaican government was very careful not to open themselves up to the charge of nesting, creating a nest of pirates. But anyway, this whole situation. This is one of the things that helps contribute to Jamaica's extraordinary contribution to British maritime resources, to in shipping and overseas commerce, the domestic and domestic industry in Britain, because so many British goods were consumed in Jamaica. They every year brought in an enormous amount of English goods, and that's been often explained away as, well, these planters were high livers and so forth. And I think that's to some extent true. They were buying goods, luxury goods and so forth, and a lot of other things that were necessary tools and so forth from Britain. But they were also bringing in goods that they knew would sell on the Spanish Main. And there's quite open trades in sometimes between the two areas. And the other thing that Jamaica was very important for was its consumption of African bodies. They never became, during this era, and not until very much later, very close to emancipation, did the black population in Jamaica become self-sustaining, though it may have lived better there because there was so much ground in Jamaica that practically every slave family living outside of a town, or outside of Kingston, really, had its own plot and had its own domestic animals and planted foodstuffs. Of course, they were expected to feed themselves. But the growing demand for slaves and Britain's enormously profitable African slave trade, all this can be people could look at the situation and say and think that Jamaica was not just the wealthiest colony, as defined by per capita wealth of free people in the island, but as a place that made a more of a contribution than probably any other colony did to Britain's economic well-being. And so they showed this in a willingness to actually spend capital from the British state to keep varying groups of soldiers in the colony from the early 18th century on. And they didn't do that anywhere else. I mean, there are a few independent companies in Georgia and in New York. And then after Nova Scotia is founded, a substantial establishment there. But this is something that they did that they didn't do anywhere else. They didn't do it in Barbados. And Jamaicans were willing to subsidize this because they were afraid of slave uprisings. And that can't come out in this particular book because that's not what it's about. But only really the French colony of Saint-Domingue outpaced Jamaica during the 18th century as an economic dynamo. And it was really took off after the end of the American War.
I wonder if we could shift a little bit to talk about the free population of color. This is maybe just a self-serving interest on my part, since it's a population that I study. And I wonder if you could you bring up some really great information about what Jamaica's urban population of color was. And could you just talk a little bit about what you found about the elite population in both Kingston and Spanish Town? And particularly, you talk about this issue of gender being an important aspect of their success or their independence, so to speak, in these urban centers.
Yeah, I can't tell you very much about Kingston, actually, because I'm sure that there are more black renters and occupants of houses, free blacks, than appear on the yearly tax list. Which is relatively small percentage of the population, actually a black population, a free black population, appears on that list. And you don't know where these free people are living, and yet every contemporary, and there's a lot of contemporary literature being produced and published in England about Jamaica in this period, and they all say that there are from between 1,000 and 2,000 free mulattoes and blacks in Kingston, and these people are very, very hard to find on that parish tax list. And but in Spanish Town, we do know a great deal as a result of this list. There are two lists in the census part of the data that came out of Sussex, and that is the a part on the free whites and another part on the free blacks, in which it lists who owns the house, what their profession is, what its value is, the number and gender of the age of the occupants. And one thing that does come out there quite clearly, and this comes out insofar as there is data on house occupancy by free blacks in Kingston as well, and that is that whereas with the white population, house ownership is heavily weighted toward males, and among the black population, it's heavily weighted toward females, and which raises the whole question of why that happened. And the conventional answer, especially after Trevor Bernard's book so heavily, his first book on Jamaica, It is usually probably most the explanation that first occurs to you is that, well, this is just a situation in which white owners are having various kinds of relationships with black women and then sponsoring them and providing them with houses and maybe even continuing these relationships. But a whole lot of these free women of color had professions of seamstress and so forth, which suggests that some of them may have actually worked their way out of slavery. And then some of the males, no doubt, because Jamaica did recruit blacks into the army when they were invaded, and they rewarded people with freedom, with manumission. So that's where some of the free blacks came from. But that's the subject that I think is opened up by my by that census that needs a lot more work on. So I'm glad to hear you're working on this as a general problem. We need to know a lot more about free blacks than we do, even though we know a lot more now than we did 30 years ago when I was starting the Atlantic History Program. The first conference we had was on free blacks, and produced a kind of nice set of essays about it, even way back then, but we didn't know very much then.
Well, there are a lot of people that are doing great work on that topic, and I think that your book will be really helpful to contextualize it. Maybe just to kind of start to wrap up a little bit, I think there's so much great data in here, and you have a lot of graphs to lay out everything. I mean, practically every page has a nice graph that shows you some really coherent, concrete aspect of a parish in Jamaica or a town. And I'm sort of curious what you hope your readers take from all that data, if you're wanting to see that data be used in certain ways, if there were certain stories that you were maybe hoping to tell but you couldn't tell within the confines of this book because you have such a large mass of information. What do you hope kind of comes out of all of this new data that's more accessible to people who can't make it to the archives in Spanish Town or Kingston?
Well, I said everything I could think of to say about that data. And it's not a data that lends itself particularly to storytelling, because you don't really, all you see is, you can invent a story about someone out of that, each person out of that data, but the data itself doesn't really give you any kind of sense of what their daily lives were like, much less, you know, some a narrative structure around which to build a story. But this is, you know, this, I've actually never been a friend to storytelling. I have to say this because it's true. I mean, early on, I asked, why were all the smart people going into physics when history is so much more complicated and challenging to get right? And I noticed that people who really liked history did so because professors told stories in their classes and anecdotes. And so I resolved, after I'd been teaching 2 or 3 years, I was never going to tell an anecdote in a class. And I never did. Because, I mean, I had a brief conversation, interesting exchange at a OAH meeting with Laurel Ulrich, and who some reason, wasn't a session on my book, Pursuits of Happiness, but somehow she was tearing into this book, and she said, I got really angry with this book because there were no women in it. But then I realized there weren't any people in it at all. And I responded by saying that when I got old, I might tell stories. But in the meantime, I wanted to do history. And I've never thought biography was history. And I've never, you know, that's been my orientation. There are a lot of people like me in my generation. And we were all very excited to be doing those kinds of things and not to be descending to what we regarded as the trivial. I know that's not the case anymore because I go and listen to these things at the John Carter Brown Library, often which are stories built on not very flimsy, on not very substantial evidence, and sometimes they're fun, but I don't often see them related to larger questions of the kind that I was determined to address, or I thought I could address, maybe. I don't know that there are any stories except the stories about the construction of the book and the construction of the documents. And these documents all grew out of almost all of them grew out of a very large story, which I tell at 80-page length in a book published by Liberty Fund on liberty in America. And it's the dispute over the removal of the capital from Spanish Town to Kingston that occurs in the mid-1750s, which is generated by the inability of the governor to persuade any parish but St. Andrews to fill out this big questionnaire, which the St. Andrews guy did. Nobody else would do it. No other parish would do it. And the refusal of the assembly to do any of the things that the metropolitan government had told him needed to be done through his instructions. And in that story, he turned to the merchants in Kingston who didn't like to go 17 miles into the country to register their ships and do all their paperwork. And so he formed a party, and that's what produced most of these documents that we can analyze. So that story is an interesting story because the Spanish Town people win, because the metropolitan government just doesn't really have the wherewithal to enforce anything, even with a few regiments of troops around there, because the troops are there to protect these people. All this comes out very strongly in the project I'm working on now. Not about that specific incident, but the mentality that produced that level of resistance comes out very strongly in this history of James Knight's unpublished history of Jamaica down to 1746. And Knight is incredible in sort of laying out in explicit terms how Jamaica thought the empire should be governed. And what he says is that Parliament has no authority over us. We don't elect any members to it. This is in 1740 or whenever he wrote those passages. In fact, he said, we have control over our own domestic affairs. And we get some help, and we'll take more help from the metropolitan state if they'll give it to us. But we're the people on the spot. We know what the problems are. We're the only people who can legislate on them. And these governors who they're sent over are generally out to make a buck, and so they you can't trust them. And so we can deal directly with the crown. But anyway, that's an aside to.
No, that's great. And did you want to, maybe we could kind of wrap up with that, if you want to say a little bit more about this new project with Knight and sort of what he brings to the question?
Well, I have this. James Knight, who was, I could just say briefly, was a, it's astonishing what I don't know about him. I don't know who he married or who his father was or how many children he had. I know he had three because he left a will. There may have been others. But anyway, he had been in Jamaica as a child, which we know only from an aside he has in a sentence in the history. And then he came back in 1712 and was and he had rented the office of a collector general, receiver general, from the patentee in London. And that guy sold it to somebody else after about 6 years, and Knight was there, but he obviously had mercantile connections because he had substantial holdings on the waterfront and came in Kingston. But he got very interested, and he became a great Jamaica patriot and very interested in correcting the misunderstanding of Jamaicans, because while metropolitans appreciate its wealth, they had a low opinion of society. It wasn't just because of the slavery, though that wasn't didn't recommend itself to anybody. To a lot of people, but it was the this guy Ned Ward who wrote a book called A Trip to Jamaica. He was never in Jamaica, but it's a scurrilous piece, and there are lots of other things like that. They're written about Jamaica. They aren't very complimentary. So he was determined to write a history that would correct and also would provide an account of what he thought was very important, which is the day-to-day history of this island. So he produced a work that I can't remember how long it is. It's well over 1,000 pages, but it is. It comes out to about, in 12-point type, it comes out to about 900 pages. And he published it in two volumes. The first volume is indeed a narrative history. The first volume being, the first couple parts of it being its history under the Spanish, and the next part being English conquest of the island. And then there's a part three that I've broken down into six different sections because it's 300 pages long, and it's a narrative history of Jamaica. In the conventional way, that is, relations between governors and the legislature, earthquakes, slave uprisings, hurricanes, all the kind of traditional things that would go into history. And it remains to this day the best account of those things because he did a lot of research in contemporary sources. He was in the legislature for 8 years. He, in addition to his early service as a crown officer, and he was a strong Whig. So he believed in consensual governance, and he believed that the only way the empire could work was by letting each of these polities pursue its own course while maintaining profound respect for the crown. The second volume is not exactly a history. It's a choreography in which it goes through a whole variety of aspects of every aspect almost you could think of in Jamaican life. And that's based mainly on his own experience and observations, but to some extent on sections on the flora and fauna are very heavily indebted to the founder of the British Museum, whose name attempted earlier escapes me, who wrote the famous natural history of, was it?
I assume you mean Sloan, or?
Yeah, Hans Sloan. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And he's quite up on the literature, although he doesn't cite very much of it, and he has contempt for a lot of it, especially the other histories that have been written. But this work, which I've written a long introduction to, in which if it comes out with the University of Virginia Press, which has wanted to publish it for some time, but the foundation that I have to back it wants an elegant book by which they seem to mean one print on very nice paper, but mainly to have from 30 to 50 contemporary illustrations. And I've finished this introduction and the manuscript, although I still have some work to do on the footnotes. In fact, when I was writing the introduction, I sort of ignored a lot of relevant, modern, recent works on that ought to be cited to send, not because I used them, but because a reader might want to pursue any of these questions. And I have to go through and do things like that. And there are a number of problems with the footnotes, but they're now, the book is there being evaluated and being assessed for how much of a subvention it may cost, which will be substantial. I think this has never been published. I should have said this earlier. Knight finished it just before he died. He died in either late 1746 or early 1747. I'm not sure. I don't really know which. But in any case, before he died, he'd finished the book and had got some sample pages of the preface. But he hadn't gotten the thing published. And his children, obviously, or whoever was handling his estate, didn't follow through on it. So that manuscript stayed in the family, I guess, until the 1780s sometime, when it came in the possession of Edward Long, who is a famous historian of Jamaica, who had published his history in 1774. But that history shows no sign of knowing anything about Knight's work. Long set out to revise his history sometime in the late 1780s, and he was going to incorporate a lot of sections out of Knight's, but that he never brought that project to fruition. So roughly, that's what I've been doing. So
well, that's fantastic, and I really hope that can come out. I'm eager to read the many hundreds of pages that it has.
And the great thing about it is, you know, that it won't be, will it? If it's published in a folio edition, it won't be searchable. In the form I've got it in now, though, it's searchable.
Even better.
Which it never has, and I hope copies somehow wind up in the hands of Trevor and other people who are other Jamaicanists. Aficionados who might find it useful to have a searchable copy. So.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking about your book. And I think for people who do tell stories, this is a great chance to understand the background and the economy and all the context that they might be missing in their own stories. So thank you so much for joining me and talking about the book.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.